think we should start. What do you think?
Maybe we can finish, wrap up in an hour. Maybe this will be a very chatty group. So, hi, everybody. I think we met when I was on the panel just now. Gina Marazzo from the University of Alabama, Birmingham. Until a year and a half ago, I was at the University of Washington in Seattle for most of my career. Who was that? Oh, I'm like, well, I knew you came in with me, but I wasn't sure where you sat. So now I'm trying to enjoy life in the Deep South, which has been really fun. So this is on prep and pep. I have no slides because the workshop presenters basically decided you probably were completely PowerPointed out and we could really just have a conversation about prep and pep. I think that this is, from my perspective, a lot less complicated than it was maybe even 3 years ago. And I think that's because the data that continue to come out about the safety and efficacy and scale up of PrEP are pretty astonishing. And I will, my bias right off is that PrEP is probably the worst thing to happen to HIV infections, new HIV infections in a long time. It's really good. Worse for the virus as opposed for the person. It's really, really bad for the virus. It's really good for control. I know you all looked confused and like, what is she talking about? Let me just tell you how I got into the PrEP business. I'm originally a sexually transmitted infection researcher, have done a lot of work on vaginitis, vaginal microbiome, vaginal health, chlamydia, some syphilis stuff. And I got into the PrEP business because I was interested in vaginal microbicides. In the old days, they were pretty crappy. They were like basically detergent and anoxinol 9. And then tenofovir was formulated, of course, as a vaginal gel in the early 2000s and was studied in three big studies. And I led one of those studies, the VOICE study, that compared vaginal tenofovir gel with oral Truvada and oral tenofovir in several thousand sub-Saharan African women. And you may remember that study did not work in the intent to treat analysis, largely because the women were so poorly adherent to all the products. It was very much like the FemPrep study, which was also in heterosexual women. So we can get into, if you're interested, talking about the database for men who have sex with men, heterosexual men, and heterosexual women. There are no data for homosexual women, as usual, but there are clear differences in the, I would say, robust nature of those data sets. And that's one of the reasons that the new trials of cabotegravir are designed differently for heterosexual women versus men who have sex with men. So all details that we can talk about, but I want to make sure that you that we get to what you want to hear about. What else was I going to say about the VOICE study? There was a per-protocol analysis where we have looked at the women who used the product and were adherent on the basis of plasma tenofovir levels, much like IPREX did. Remember back in the day when the IPREX study came out? How many people are familiar with IPREX study? Many of you. So for those of you who aren't, and then I really will stop talking and just take questions. The IPREX study was the very first randomized control trial of oral Truvada for pre-exposure prophylaxis. It only enrolled men who have sex with men and transgender women. Most of those people were enrolled in Central South America. Some were enrolled in the United States, not a ton, and some in Europe and a few in Africa, not very many. And the intent to treat analysis, and people were randomized, they were very, very, first of all, I should say, very high-risk men in probably had a baseline incidence of HIV in the absence of any intervention of about 9 to 10%, so very high risk. Lots of reports of condomless receptive anal intercourse, lots of STDs. The initial results of that study were surprisingly disappointing to a lot of people. When you looked at the intent to treat analysis, the overall protection was only about 40-ish percent, okay, 37 to 40%, depending on how you looked at it. When you looked at it by adherence, it actually went up considerably, so got up towards 60%. And then when they looked at it by detection of tenofovir in peripheral blood mononuclear leukocytes, it actually was estimated to be about 92%. So it was kind of the first, one of the first studies that started to disentangle this problem with assuming that what you randomize people to is what they use. And that was not the case. And it makes me question tons and tons of randomized control trials that have been done where we assumed that people took whatever they were randomized to. But the pharmacokinetic modeling for that study was so strong that people really believed that that 92% efficacy was probably a better estimate than what was seen in the intent to treat analysis, which was that 37 to 40% efficacy. It's kind of turned things on its head because the randomized control trial was always the holy grail. And now you're like, wait a minute, it's this per protocol analysis that you're looking at by the detection of drug that we're believing. And I have to say, those numbers have been borne out, right? When you look at real-world studies, and we can talk about PROUD study, and we can talk about IPERGE, which are the two big studies in men who have sex with men. First one was in the United Kingdom, second one in Paris or France. Both presented updates at IAS last month in Paris. Amazing efficacy of PrEP. I mean, amazing efficacy. And Kaiser Permanente database just presented another update on their database using PrEP in their population. Amazing efficacy. I don't think they've seen any incident HIV infections in the men who are on PrEP. So just to say, fantastic data for men who have sex with men. Not so great for women. And the trick for me is to try to figure out if that reduced observation of efficacy in women is all adherence, or are there other factors at play? We know that tenofovir and emtricitabine do not get to the cervico-vaginal tissue as well as they get to the rectum. Once again, biologically sexist situation where women are the losers. Their rectums aren't the losers. They're getting exposed in the rectum through anal sex. That's great. They're going to be protected probably just as much as men are through anal sex, and we shouldn't forget that that's a fairly common sexual behavior that we don't talk a lot about with heterosexual women. But the rectum's really good because you can take a dose of Truvada and you are at steady state if you take it daily in 5 days, and you probably have protective levels really very quickly, 48 to 72 hours. I tell people 5 days to be safe because that's a steady state is reached. The cervix, probably much more like 2 weeks, maybe 10 days. But to be safe, I say 2 weeks, and some people actually say three. So this is a great point about counseling, how you counsel people. You're starting PrEP. When is it really safe for you to have unprotected sex? The answer is much clearer for anal sex, rectal exposures, than it is for cervicovaginal exposure. And that's a frustrating, that's a tough thing to sort of have a conversation about. But for women, I like them to be on PrEP a little longer. So I'll stop there. I mean, I could just keep talking, but I think I would love to hear people's reactions, thoughts, and your specific questions about some of these issues, because I know you have them. Yes. And if you could just tell me where you're from. Sorry, I don't know everybody. Okay, thanks, Michael.
Question about the IPERGE sub-analysis they talked about. I know it's small numbers.
Yeah. Yep. Sure. So the IPERGE study, for those of you who aren't familiar with it, was a study in France that randomized men who have sex with men and were actively engaged in condomless receptive anal intercourse in the past whatever time frame to either placebo or Truvada, as I recall. Was it placebo or was it delayed? I know I can't remember. That was the UK study. Anyway, the bottom line is that the PrEP users Let me go back. They were randomized to event-driven Truvada. So they were asked to take a Truvada pill within the 24 hours before having sex and 2 hours after having unprotected sex. So that was the active group. The other group did not do anything. And the reason that this was acceptable was because at that point, peri-event-driven, sex-driven PrEP was not really a recommended approach. The bottom line, no pun intended, is that the group that used event-driven PrEP in this way had an 87% reduction in HIV acquisition. So it drove the rate of HIV down remarkably. The caveat to that study is if you look at their New England Journal paper, the average number of pills per week in those men who used event-driven Truvada was 4. So they were having a lot of sex and using a lot of daily preps. They were doing it 4 out of 7 days. Interestingly enough, that's exactly what the IPREX study showed when you look at the pharmacokinetic modeling for the minimum number of daily prep that you would need for a week to get protected from anal sex. So they sort of, it's interesting because it was a natural experiment and they ended up doing what they needed to do. So that made the IPREX or the IPREX investigators a little bit nervous because they felt like maybe this wasn't really as much event-driven prep as we had wanted to look at. Maybe we were really looking at more sustained 4 days a week delivery of Truvada. So at the IAS meeting this July, last month, they presented the sub-analysis of the people who were less sexually active. And I can't remember how they defined it, but it was certainly less than once a week. So it would have been at least a dose, I mean, not less than once a week. It was around once a week, so I just don't remember the exact number. And then they looked at the efficacy in that subgroup, and they showed that there were no HIV infections, if I recall correctly, in the group that had lower rates of sex or lower incidence of sex and had used that product. So I think their concerns were, number one, was this really representative population? They were in the study. Is it going to work for everybody? I mean, that's always a concern. And then number two, were the numbers enough to really make a widespread sort of recommendation for event-driven prophylaxis? My feeling is that we've all kind of been using it based on the IPREX data, I think. I mean, most people or many people that I talk to don't really want to go on every single day prep, particularly when they know they're not going to be at risk. They know they're not going to be having sex. So I think people have been doing periodic seasons or risk phases of prep and then kind of coming off, coming on, depending on what's been going on. I think event-driven prep is just a natural extension of that. So I'm pretty confident about it with the limited data. So a long answer, but sort of to say that database is probably not as good as you might like. Anybody seen event-driven prep like that fail? Anybody using it or tell your patients to use it, I should ask? Yeah. No, it's okay. Yes. I mean, I think there are some people who won't do anything else, and it's like, I mean, to me, it's harm reduction, right? I mean, because the concern would be, what would be the reasons not to use it? It would be concerns that it would increase the likelihood of resistance. It would give people a false sense of security and cause more behavioral disinhibition than you already are seeing in these situations. And what else would there be? Unanticipated toxicity, right? Why would you see that? I think none of those, the resistance was not a concern in any of the PrEP studies unless people were acutely infected and it was unrecognized. That's the only time we saw resistance. Behavioral disinhibition is irrelevant because everybody's having sex without condoms anyway. And there's no evidence of toxicity. So that's my feeling. So tell me your story and then we'll come back to these guys. 85-year-old.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sorry, post-disposition.
Mm-hmm.
So his kidney function went down.
On daily tenofovir.
Yeah. So I put him on his entrance and Truvada.
Mm-hmm.
And it's still his kidney function.
Okay.
So once I finished with him and did PEP, I started him on PrEP every other day.
Okay. Okay. So he's just on a reduced dose of regular PrEP because of his kidney dysfunction. Okay.
Yes, and then the second patient is a patient that he's not very sexually active, but probably 3 times a week he's having sex. Considering. But
I love the standards here at this meeting. It's like it always makes me feel really old. IPREX study.
Mm-hmm. Like, okay, well, yeah. So,
yeah.
You know, so he's doing it and he's doing really well.
Okay.
Very consistently.
Okay. Yeah, you can't argue with the efficacy that they saw in IPREGAY. I mean, it was 87%, and it was exactly the same as what they saw in the UK PROUD study. So just to finish up before I go to your questions and then you in the back, the PROUD, so there were two big studies that followed on the randomized controlled placebo-controlled studies of PrEP. One was the Ypres study that I mentioned that looked at peri-event-driven PrEP. And then the UK study was also enrolled men who had sex with men. And I think they gave them the option of deferring PrEP for a year or having them start immediately. And the group, was it randomized? Okay. And the, because I couldn't remember, there was a big discussion of whether that was ethical at this point. Yes, absolutely. So it was, so they were randomized, and the DSMB stopped it right around the same time as Ypres Gay, if I'm not mistaken. I can't remember. But that was also because they saw an 87% reduction in HIV in the men who were on immediate PrEP. So clearly deferring PrEP in this high-risk group was not going to, not the thing to do. So let's go over here. And
mm-hmm. tanking, mm-hmm. how you deal with it. Second question, what you advise someone who's in a discordant couple where the HIV negative partner doesn't have any other outside members, and the positive partner is controlled.
Mm-hmm.
And third is
just a few small questions.
Overdoing the frequency of testing.
Yeah. Okay, great questions. Did everybody hear those? I'll repeat them just in case. So the first question was what to do when renal dysfunction occurs on daily Truvada or TDF FTC. We have no approved alternatives. I mean, technically, you've got to sort of play with it. The question then becomes, are you willing to play with the dose to preserve your kidney function and get what we think is going to be an adequate coverage level? And the adequate coverage level, I think, again, for MSM, we don't know what it is for women, would be at least 4 doses a week. So you could start with every, you know, you could sort of stop, make sure their kidney function returns to normal, and then start them back on a 4-day-a-week kind of. I mean, every other day is probably a reasonable thing. You know, at that point, you got to ask yourself, you're on a toxic drug that you haven't had particularly good reaction to, then does the harm outweigh the benefit? And that's a conversation you have to have with the patient. It does bring up the logical question, what about TAF, right? Has anybody prescribed TAF for PrEP yet? Any concerns with starting? And what were you thinking, Tony? And tell us about that, and then we'll come back to your other questions.
You know, I mean, the Discover study is ongoing, and we have 200 people in the Discover study, randomized either TAF FTC versus TDF FTC. And, you know, there's enough data to support doing the study. You know, the investigators were sure it's pretty convincing. Higher concentrations in the PBMC is, and so, you know, I had prescribers who worked with me who really felt strongly that on patients with impaired renal function that Descovy was a better way to go.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a handful of people who are on
Fascinating.
Descovy, and you know, I've talked to the people at Gilead. I was uncertain about it at first, but again, as you talked about, you know, we're trying to do some harm reduction here. So what's the safest thing to do for that segment of patients and still provide the protection that we can?
Yeah. So Tony's saying
know,
yes.
You know, what I don't know is what, this is all pretty recent in the last, you know, 6 months, is I don't know whether the insurance companies are in that little window where they're thinking this is an HIV infection, and so we're paying for it.
Right. It's that convenient confusion about the indication for the drug that we like.
Yeah.
Yeah, that may be indeed the case. So anybody know what there are people who are in my position who've given talks and who have slides that say do not use TAF for PrEP. Any idea why there is a concern?
The plasma levels are so much lower.
Tissue, genital tissue levels are lower. So as Tony said, penetration into PBMC is excellent. The real rub is that we don't really know where it needs to be in the genital tract to protect. Like, is it enough to have it concentrated in the cells and the lymph nodes so that when it drains from the genital tract, it's completely taken out? Or do you want something that's active at the cervicovaginal epithelium or the rectal epithelium in the absence of PBMCs because you got other epithelial cells there? And we don't know the answer. I think that randomized control trial is great, and we'll have the answer pretty soon.
Much of you investigated whether they're taking non-steroidals. It's amazing to me how many people assume 800 milligrams because it's available out there.
Yeah, non-steroidals are probably not really good for your kidneys either. But we will have an answer. We will have an answer soon. In the meantime, you know, again, it comes back to the idea of equipoise, right? You have a set of data. You know there's limitations on the data. You know people are going to get HIV because you still see it every single day, right? And these guys, mostly men, are really getting it a ton. So with informed consent and telling them there's not an indication for this drug, it's not approved yet, it's under study, you know, I think it's reasonable to try. The concern has been that there's not adequate tissue levels in the genital tract, but we don't really know enough about it to say that that's a non-starter. Let me just come back to your other question really quickly. Your second one was a discordant couple. Let's save that because I think we're going to want to get into that a little bit more. And your third one was frequency of testing. Yes, I think. Well, what do people think? I think frequency of testing is probably going to become more sparse as these drugs continue to be very safe. I mean, my feeling is if you're going to see toxicity, it's either going to be really early or really, really late, right? Just like you do in most HIV care. So I would agree with you. Let's come back to your discordant couple in a second. And I think you had your hand up all the way back there, and then you did too, and then you.
We were just talking about the identification of intermittent prep use.
Yeah. Yeah, I think a week before and a week after is absolutely super safe. I mean, never say never, but I think that's a really good approach and probably could get away even with a little bit shorter windows, but to be safe. So you had a question, and then we'll come back to you. You're so optimistic. I love it. The dipivirine ring, which we can certainly talk about if people have questions about it, is now being reviewed for regulatory approval. So, and I think it'll probably be a go.
It'll be a tool in the toolkit. You know, if you've got CKD stage 3 and they're female, so you don't feel great about intermittent. I mean, like, it may not be for everybody, but I think that level of nuanced discussion that we're talking about, kind of like situational, I've got 85, I've got a serious one.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and the reality is people need options. I mean, no one option works for everybody. I mean, if it's the only option, you try to make it work, but there are lots of reasons. I mean, the real promise of rings is combining them with contraception for multipurpose prevention technology, and that's really the holy grail. And we know very well from the VOICE study and the FemPrep study that young women taking pills in sub-Saharan Africa, just like oral contraceptive pills, is a non-starter. I mean, the failure rates for oral contraception in young populations of women in those settings is like 18%. So the pill thing is not working. So yes, I agree with you. I'd be interested to hear what other people think. I mean, I think that from somebody who originally came from the STI field, now has worked in the HIV field, even thinking about getting those structures to talk and to work together when incident STI in a young gay man is probably the best indication for PrEP, you know, making PrEP available in STI care settings or sexual health care settings is a huge priority. Even that, it certainly has just happened in Birmingham, Alabama, just happened. So I think that when you throw these other things into the mix, it's going to be a huge challenge, especially when you're talking about injectables, as we were talking about on the panel. I mean, there's a lot of, particularly given the technical aspects of what you got to do with cabotegravir, huge, huge in the cold chain. I mean, all of that is a really big deal. But if only we were faced with those challenges. I mean, if cabotegravir works, and I hope it does, I think it would be great to try to work around those things. I mean, cabotegravir to me for 8 weeks could be fantastic for the sorts of things that people were talking about, you know, deployment, people are going away, they don't really want to take a pill, they can't, confidentiality, which people don't often think about. In Africa, we think about it a lot of the women threw the study products away because they didn't want to have any evidence of having anything to do with HIV in their house for the stigma. So I think stuff we don't think about a lot because we're so, it's so normalized here. So other people want to respond to that because I think there's, yeah, okay, please.
So I'm only 20 miles south of Seattle in a different county, and PrEP providers are scarce and very hard to come by. And so my thought as you brought that up was if we're trying to roll this out to the primary care community, they're already looking at me saying, I have to do lipid screening, PEPs, all this other stuff. Now you're making me ask the crazy sexual question. I can't ask that. But then to come, make it even more complex, it's not just Truvada we're going to teach you how to use it, mm-hmm. and how to monitor, but then there's all these other things. I think it's already hard. How are we going to penetrate the primary mm-hmm. care setting? It does seem to be something we're already facing, and we only have mm-hmm. one product.
I will say, though, I agree with you, too, but with one caveat. Remember when PrEP first came out, we were all excited at how well it worked, and there was no uptake, right? And we were talking about how we could get primary care providers to learn to do it, just like we wish they could do other stuff that we want them to do. And there was like this, oh, no. But now you look at the prescriptions, and you look at where the prescriptions are being – I mean, you saw that CID paper where the prescriptions in men have gone like that, I mean, off the scale. I don't remember the data on the source of the prescriptions in terms of the care setting, but I have no doubt that a lot of that's happening more in primary care. So I think maybe our expectations were a little bit too low. It may be, I agree, I'm sure you still get a lot of pushback, but I think as the word gets out that this is really working, it's really effective, hopefully we'll see more of that. I do agree these options may shift things back to more prevention specialists. Are they going to be prevention specialists in HIV care settings? Problem with that is that young black men in Birmingham, Atlanta, Nashville are not going to come to an HIV clinic, and that's our big problem there, and that's not true in Seattle. So it's a really, really, I think we have to think proactively about that because we are already behind the eight ball, even getting TDF-FTC to people. You have been very patient. Yeah. So what would you use? Yeah. But post-exposure prophylaxis has Truvada and an integrase inhibitor, so. Yeah, you're out on a limb. I mean, because then with Combivir, you're talking about a lot more toxicity. Maybe not more different, but I agree. I mean, I think that they should work. The thing about PrEP, though, that is we can't really assume anything because I think we don't know everything we need to know about the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics in the genital tract. So I think sometimes you think drugs get there and they don't necessarily get there very well. I think integrase inhibitors are not great penetrators of the genital tract, if I'm not mistaken, even though, you know, I mean, in so anyway, I think, yes, you're probably right, but I would be cautious making up regimens just because we don't know. Yeah, again, you get back to the risk-benefit ratio, right? I mean, these are healthy people, right? So, again, how much do you want to prevent the acquisition of infection, which I agree I'm fully committed to preventing, versus using those drugs? Yes. Right, right. It's like it's the hardest part of treating hepatitis C. It's not about learning what the drugs do. It's all about trying to figure out what you can work around to get. Yeah, so you're right. So if we do have more options and there is a dapivirine ring, for example, there's nothing to say that the insurance will decide to cover that, right? I mean, so yeah, that's a problem. Hopefully they will. Did you have a comment, question?
Which
Yes. Hey, thank you.
I'm LaDon from Anniston.
Nice to meet you.
We currently have a patient interested in PrEP that has 80% of his stomach lost his weight, so his primary time began to eat ice cream to gain weight. He was a diabetic prior to
this sounds like a real Alabama story. Sounds like S Town.
Will he be able to absorb PrEP? So, you know, they do not allow, as of right now, a rat for PrEP in Alabama.
Who doesn't allow a rat for PrEP? Gilead?
The best I can do is contact the Georgia rep, which I have emailed him.
Yeah. Let's talk about that, because I think there are some people that might be able to help us. I hadn't heard that before. And we have, you know, obviously started a PrEP clinic in Birmingham, and we have a lot of interactions with Gilead Foundation. So let's talk about that. With regard to your stomach question and absorption, I just have no idea. It's not a situation that I have encountered. My guess is that it would be fine, but it's complete guess. Yeah, you could check a level. Could check a level. Is it commercially available? You'd have to send it to Craig Hendricks' lab or Angela Kashuba's lab at UNC. But yeah, we can talk more about that for sure. Yeah. Anybody else had that problem and know the answer? All right. Other questions, comments? Some other people had their hands up. Yes. Mm-hmm.
But I recently got a new HIV patient who was positive in July, was negative in April, and had a prescription for PrEP.
Mm-hmm.
He says he's a little elusive and vague, but it seems to me that he was definitely not filling it in those last 3 months. And his resistance testing shows no mutations. But would you be worried about missing, like if that's wild type virus?
The standard. Yeah. I would not be worried if his baseline genotype is normal. I think, you know, in the PrEP studies where people got TDF-FTC monotherapy because they were acutely infected and it wasn't detected at the time and they were randomized to the active product, they had mutations that were detected later. So I think it's not the sort of thing that's transient and then, you know, goes away. So I think you should be okay. I think it should be okay. Something else that made me want to ask a question, but I can't think of what it was. Other questions? Yes.
How are people managing the STI risk of patients that continue to practice unsafe sex? Anecdotally, in San Diego, we've seen our rates go higher, gonorrhea, and maybe it's the worst.
Yeah, so great question. And I'll talk about this a little tomorrow in my plenary talk or my main lecture. You know, when we first started seeing this increase in STIs in this population of men, and mostly men who have sex with men, the question was it really because PrEP was taking off, or was it because we were screening more because people were on PrEP? I think it's probably a little bit of both. I think it's more that there's more risky and protected sex, because I'm not sure that anything could drive the numbers the way that I'll show you are going up tomorrow. I don't think we know how to handle it, and I think that's a huge question. And some of the data, I mean, you can screen and you can treat, and then you can treat partners, but really how well are we doing that? We're not really doing it as well as we could, plus the burden on the system to screen these folks every 3 months and sometimes probably even more frequently based on how much sex they're having at all three sites if they're exposed. Huge cost, huge person power, and then when they're positive, because a third of them are, that means a whole other cascade of events. So I don't think we've really quite grappled with the implications of that yet. That's why the Epergay study, which I'll talk about tomorrow, did a follow-on study where they randomized people to perisexual doxycycline versus no doxycycline. Yeah. And, I mean, they were so, like, I mean, literally a third of the people on PrEP in the prospective cohort studies, whether you look at IPREX, Epergay, or PROUD, got STDs, bacterial or syphilis, chlamydia, gonorrhea, or syphilis. So they randomized them to doxycycline around sex, just like they took Truvada around sex, versus not doing that, and they showed a marked decline in the acquisition of, guess what, of those three STIs I mentioned, syphilis, and chlamydia, not gonorrhea. And what's the concern with gonorrhea? Antimicrobial resistance. So people are, I think it was great because, like, we needed a kick in the pants in the STI field to sort of say we've got to think outside of the box and, you know, let's look at this, even if it sounds crazy, to people who were worried about antibiotic resistance and exposure. But it is really concerning with gonorrhea, considering we have only one antibiotic that really reliably treats the pharynx in particular. So I don't know. What are you guys doing? I mean, are you screening your tails off? Their tails off? Probably. You are, right? And how are you dealing with that? How often are you screening? Are you doing every 3 months? CDC says every 6 months. I don't think that's enough. It really probably needs to be every three. Any thoughts about that? Separate? Okay. They won't pay for. Yeah. 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 So there are a couple approaches to that little cost problem. I'm not endorsing them. I'm just seeing people have done them. They have screened the pharynx and put it in a cervical and labeled it cervical. They have screened at all three sites and combined them, swished the swabs in the transport media, and then because do you care? You're not at this point anymore because you're going to use the same thing. Just saying, there could be creative ways around the companies or whoever's desire to extort more money from us. But I agree with you. The pharynx, I think, I mean, the real question with the pharynx is there was a nice little article in the New York Times a couple weeks ago about this because WHO came out with a big piece on gonococcal resistance and the lack of drugs to treat it. The real problem with the pharynx is that people think it's a breeding ground for resistance because we have non-pathogenic Neisseria species in the throat and in your gums, and they think there's a lot of genetic exchange between Neisseria gonorrhea and the Neisseria in your throat, and that that's a great place to sort of harbor the development of resistance. In the population, it doesn't really do anything other than serve as an ongoing source of transmission. Has anybody seen sore throat due to gonorrhea? Because I have. I mean, I don't believe it's always, always asymptomatic. I've seen at least one or two cases. I think it's pretty rare. But I think it can happen. So, yeah, I don't know what to tell you. I mean, it's other thoughts. I mean, I think pairing, again, it gets into this concept of pairing sexual. I really think we need to go to the sexual health model. Like the STI screening's fine, but this is an opportunity to get people in, talk to them about how PrEP is going, talk to them about other things that may be involving their tendency to have sometimes not very safe sex. And I don't mean condoms, but I mean situationally unsafe sex. So I would like to see that, but that's going to take a lot of effort. Other questions, thoughts? Yes. And we'll get back to your question.
In PrEP studies, do they calculate the risk reduction per follow-up time period or is it per exposure per time? If you are at this exposure,
So the intent to treat analysis is just a straightforward randomization event-driven analysis over time. So it doesn't stratify people at all by how sexually active they are. Is that what you're asking?
Yeah. Especially for the behavior-driven proof of access, there might be an underestimate or overestimate of the efficacy of the drug intervention. Like there's one estimate, say, example, one in 1,000 risk of the one sexual exposure. Then if you have somebody who has sex 7 times a week compared to once a week, then that person
right.
is 7 times less risk of the
Yeah, no, it's true. The thing is, it's a Russian roulette, right? You never know. Which, I mean, not risk from not all acts is the same. So that's part of the challenge, right? Because you can have sex with a partner who has a very high genital load. You can have sex with a partner who's not infected. So that kind of mix, you can never figure out what that is in any study. That's why the sort of randomization is supposed to take care of all that. I think in the event-driven analysis, I mean, it's really encouraging that it worked just as well as the daily prophylaxis, or, you know, or at least the daily prophylaxis, in the UK study. But I don't know that we can get down to the level of analysis that you're thinking of. It would be nice. But the efficacy suggests that it works regardless of all those things. I mean, the magnitude of the reduction may differ depending on the kinds of sex you're having and how frequently, but I think you can be pretty comfortable it works if you're loaded, appropriately loaded. You think so?
Because I have many patients who come and ask me, more patients ask me about just taking the pill one day and they know they're going to get involved in sex rather than taking it daily.
I think that's generally true. I think the issue is that so many people have so much sex that there's, again, this four times a week is probably more what we're looking at, but I agree with you. And I wouldn't hesitate to use it around sexual acts. I mean, I really think that it's safe and it's probably okay to do. I mean, it's effective. Other questions? I want to get back to your discordant couple question before it's a little warm in here. I feel like people are like nodding off. So you asked about prescribing PrEP in a discordant couple where the HIV positive person is fully suppressed on therapy, sort of the situation that Dr. Sag presented in the panel. Is it different than what we talked about in the panel, or were you? Yeah, it's fine. Because I'd like to hear what you guys do, because there were some differences of opinion on the panel. I don't know if that really came out, particularly in the pregnant women. So let's start with that situation, or let's start with why doesn't somebody give me a case from a serodiscordant couple that you've had? Have you had anybody had one? What you want to tell me about it, and then we can go from there. Hey.
So I have a serodiscordant couple. He is HIV positive, very well controlled, very compliant with his therapy. He and his wife, who is HIV negative, have been trying for years to have a baby. She's been on PrEP. And so they finally did get pregnant after a lot of tries. And Jody Deanna came and met with the patient, and they decided to take her off.
Mm-hmm.
Because her point was that we just don't know what the teratogenics are for the Truvada, and what kind of potential defects a baby can have, especially in light of the fact that they've tried so hard for some time.
Right. Yeah. So everybody hear that? I think that's a really great example of how you have to individualize the conversation. So there were several people on the panel today who said in terms of this concept of periconception PrEP, which is the month before and the month after, which is what's in the CDC guidelines, actually, versus just, continue it throughout pregnancy. And I was a little surprised with the sort of confidence of the continue it throughout pregnancy. How many people take care of pregnant women and would go ahead and continue it throughout pregnancy? So you would, Shauna. Other people, anybody stop it after a month? Or is anybody following the CDC treatment guidelines that say do it? Yeah. Yeah, one patient. Okay. Right. Yeah, I would agree. So your case is a great example where they were not going to let anything mess this up because they had tried so hard, and they were clearly, you had a partner who was very committed to using condoms, and the woman wanted to minimize any risk to the fetus. Remember the thing that people sometimes think, we know it's safe in pregnancy for treatment. We do. But the difference here is you're taking a drug, giving it to an HIV uninfected person, and then exposing that fetus to the drug. So it's a different risk benefit calculation. You know, it's not, so it's a little bit of a different conversation. So I agree with you. I have a conversation. I talk with them. I think it's fine to continue throughout pregnancy if they want to do that. And if there are any concerns, and we come back to this idea of PrEP as an anxiolytic. I mean, to me, it's a huge anti-anxiety drug, right? So my story in the clinic is that I had a lot of, long-term male couples in my HIV clinic. They were serodiscordant. They had used condoms forever, most of the time, probably not all the time. They mostly hadn't had outside partners. And then when PrEP became available, the seronegative one came in and said, I'd like to go on PrEP because I'm really, you know, I'd love to like actually have sex without a condom. My experience was in several situations like that, that person went on PrEP for a few months and then stopped it because it was almost like PrEP was a bridge to realizing that I actually could have, say, sex with my partner who's totally suppressed. And that, I thought, was fantastic because it had sort of, like, removed this huge barrier for them. So again, it's that conversation that it's just not a one-size-fits-all, I don't think. Yes?
In those situations, do you pre-counsel your patient that if you get a severe viral infection or you get influenza or you get an immunization, maybe you should hold off on sex around that period? Blips that can occur.
Yeah, I have never done that because I feel like blips happen just like viral infection happens. And I think it would be very anxiety provoking to sort of have people, I mean, I think you have to be sensible if you know, look at all the Zika virus that happened. People were really sick and they got back from Zika endemic areas, had sex and immediately gave their partner Zika virus. So people can't, they're not going to defer sex because they don't feel good. That's one thing I've learned. That was the point I was trying to make about the Zika virus thing. Cause if you actually read the Zika transmission stuff, it's a riot. People are sick. They come home, they're still sick and they immediately have sex with their partner there. They miss them so much after 4 days or something. I think it's a good thought. I mean, I thought where you were going with that.
A pregnant woman, you know, and they've stopped using condoms, you know, that the fetus is a much greater risk if you require.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's not an unreasonable idea. Again, it's something you might want to think about on a case-by-case basis. Yes. Doesn't want him to use condoms.
Doesn't want him to use condoms.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a conversation that you have to have with the couple.
Mm-hmm.
As a couple and mm-hmm. then with the individual.
Mm-hmm.
Going to be taking breath as an individual. Mm-hmm. So it was a 3-week process.
Mm-hmm.
But we finally, I mean, again, it's a case by case, even though you explain now the vital suppression being one of the best ways to mm-hmm. prevent.
Potentially transmit.
Not knowing when, so he wanted to make sure that she was protected. She was not really very interested in it, but she finally said, okay, I'll do it because this is going to de-stress him
mm-hmm.
from becoming.
It's not the scenario you think of happening very often.
Yes.
Very interesting. So. Very interesting. Well, I think the data, again, that have come out in Paris, so the follow-up data from the partner study that I mentioned on the panel, the HPN-052 data, and then the opposites attract study. I mean, they have had no transmissions from fully suppressed people. It's pretty remarkable. So I think, again, as Mike Sykes said, we're as close to zero as we can get. So I think this is where this concept of PrEP as a bridge for getting to comfort with that place. I mean, you know, we've grown up so, and our patients are in these situations where it's a huge mental block to get over that. The other thing I wanted to say, too, when I was discussing that first case on PrEP that Dr. Sag presented, I do think that anybody who comes in to ask for PrEP should get it. So unless there's a biochemical, physiological abnormality or something that's a contraindication. So my point was not so much that the guy didn't need it, but more that, you know, I think that knowing those data about how effective viral suppression is in reducing the likelihood of transmission is a really important part of the conversation. I agree. Sometimes people come in and Like the couple that I mentioned to you before, the two men who had been together forever and said they were monogamous, you know, they did the PrEP thing, and then like 6 months later they came in and they both had gonorrhea. So, you know, they clearly, I mean, part of it is that when, I'm sure you guys have this with long-standing patients, especially people who you know in the context of a marriage or a relationship, they often aren't comfortable telling you that they're stepping out. So I have seen that, and then, you know, the biology betrays them, the pathogen betrays them. So does that, yeah. Yes. So go back to the HB10052 study, right, which was a study that delayed or immediately gave antiretroviral therapy to the positive person and then or waited until their CD4 count fell and then looked at transmission and showed, you know, the 99% now in the latest analysis reduction. Of the HIV infections that occurred, 33% were from outside partners, and they're never really talked about. I mean, it's like that study is sort of like supposedly this pure terrarium thing where they put everybody in a glass case and they gave them, you know, deferred or immediate. Actually, if you look at the total number of HIV infections, nobody really talks about the fact that 33% of the infections occurred. I forget what the number was, but it's a large number of infections happened completely outside the context of that relationship, regardless of what those people did. Yes. 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 So this sort of relentless focus on the couple forgets the sexual network concept, which HIV researchers have not really gotten that interested in until pretty recently. So it's a really, really important point. And I'm always surprised. Like it's so stupid. I should never be surprised by anything. But every once in a while, I'm like, ugh.
Any comments on post-exposure? Whether
yeah. I think any three-drug regimen works. I have nothing new to say about post-exposure prophylaxis. I actually went back and looked before this session on to sort of make sure there was nothing new. I mean, I think the question's going to be, are we going to get to injectables eventually, just like we're getting to injectables for treatment and everything else, and are we going to be able to give people a shot, just like we give them a shot of any gamma globulin thing? And so I don't have any – I have not seen failures. Have people seen failures? Pep comment? Yeah.
But I just had a question on how the timing I'm getting on that.
PEP?
In your clinic population, if there's a, or in your practice, if somebody has it, do you give them the medications, then do the counseling, or you?
Sooner is better. You want the medications in their body yesterday or several. No, pretty much. I don't never say never, but yeah. I think you want the medication in them as soon as possible. I mean, the New York State guidelines are within 48 hours, right? The CDC guidelines are 72, but the sooner the better. And that's true in all the animal models where, you know, if you start going back, you had a question. So you mean they're on PEP, they go to PrEP, and then... Yeah. And why do they... They go to PEP because they're nervous and they want another drug. I see. And they just want an additional class coverage. Okay. Super PrEP. PEP. PEP. That's a great question. Yeah. That's a great question. I'm not aware of any published data on that. I'm sure it happens a lot. It's a great question. What are people doing?
Has anybody else seen that, or do we just have a weird situation?
Where are you? Oh, well, there. There you have it. Yeah, I mean, come on. No, but I will say, you reminded me one thing that, again, 2 years ago, when we wrote the IAS USA prevention guidelines for JAMA, we had to like remind ourselves, or somebody had to say it and we had to talk about it, but you know, multiple episodes of PEP, people should be on PrEP. And I don't think that has necessarily, I mean, this group knows that, but I'm not sure that's gotten into the common language yet when you think about particularly ER providers who may do it. So that's a really important point. But to your point, I don't know that, I mean, when you think of the treatment, when you think of the failures on PrEP, they're so well taken PrEP, they're so vanishingly rare. I can't imagine that adding that additional class of drug in the integrase inhibitor is going to buy you that much more, except for reassurance. Again, it's an expensive anxiolytic. Yeah. I mean, I'm not dissing it, but no, but the data would support that you don't need it, and there are no data to support additive prevention efficacy. Yes.
Uh-huh. Post-exposure prophylaxis. And the way we have that over there is they go to the emergency room, they have the evaluation, the emergency room gives them 3-5 days of
And then they come to your clinic. Right.
Before the end of that.
Right.
But sometimes I have some patients that have been raised and they come 2 or even 3 days after the last dose. So the question is, what is the time that you can tell sometimes we are dealing with homeless women, or let's say patient, we have some male patient coming for that have been raped, and they had all the problems, they do not keep their appointment when they're supposed to.
Yeah.
So the question
good question.
Is how many days after those and you were willing to start again?
Yeah. That's a great question. I would say it's, again, a risk-benefit issue. So for Truvada, you can detect levels up to a week in the plasma. So I would say it's a pretty good, I mean, if they're in within a week, you're going to have a tail there. And if you start it again, you're just going to build it back up. So I don't see any downside to restarting it, certainly within that week time frame. I mean, I think if you get beyond that, it's going to be how concerned is the patient and how bad was the exposure, you know, what's your risk estimate. For some people, you know, who might have had really concerning exposures, or they don't remember, or if it was violent rape, I would just start it again and go for the whole 4 weeks. I mean, I think that would be the better part of whatever. It's a complete judgment, but I don't see the downside to it. The question is, the key thing is, the duration is important, but the timeliness of that first dose is the most important thing. The fact that they got those 3 days, you know, probably got a great, great introduction, right, to whatever you need to do to stop the virus from replicating. If you can at least play catch up in that sort of 3 to 5 days afterwards, I would go ahead and do it. I don't know what the exact time frame is where I'd say it's not worth it. I mean, I can't tell you. I think that it depends on the conversation with the woman. I would probably take it if it were me, just because I don't want to get HIV. I think so. Yeah. And I'll see if I can find any information for you. I haven't heard that sort of interrupting. It's not like, you know, you interrupt a course of treatment, like for syphilis, where you've got to start all over again if you miss a dose of benzathine penicillin over a certain period of time. So, you know, it's all about getting effective levels of the drug at the vulnerable sites. It's a great question. Yeah, it's a really great question. Shauna, and then go back to you. So.
I have a practical question more for the group than medical. We have a good relationship with our health department where probably 90% of my PrEP patients come by referral. But the hard part is getting them in a timely manner. And so I'm wondering how other people do that. If you get referrals where they've had an HIV test and they're trying to get in a timely manner. I mean, we just kind of defaulted to repeat the HIV test. The rapid testing through Ryan White that we use because they're high risk. So I don't know. I just feel like we're kind of chasing our tail to try to get all these patients in. Anybody have strategies?
Yeah.
We also do a lot of referrals with the county health department, and we're in like a big, huge
Got infected. Yeah. Yeah.
So then you'd have a whole lot to get the patient. They didn't want to have the resources to follow the patient, but there was a plan to start it. And unfortunately, the provider, they had a partner and he left.
Yeah. I mean, that would be the ideal thing, a quick prep start, just like, you know, quick contraception, right? You know? Right.
Yeah.
I think that's really good. Even 2 weeks. I mean, 30 days would be great, but anything to bridge them, because they clearly are incredibly high risk. Did you want to comment on that? I know somebody had a question over here. Was it about this or?
No, actually regarding the timing.
Yeah.
Stopping the PrEP, actually, I read they're recommending within 3 days, within 72 hours, is the best results.
To start it. Yes.
But the benefits didn't show up after 7 days, so there is no much.
Right, but what he was asking, this is somebody who's had it for the first 3 days and then doesn't show up, 3 to 5 days, and then doesn't show up to get the rest of the month medication, maybe 2 or 3 days late. So it's a treatment interruption. So then do you just pick up and start it again? Is it worth doing that? Yeah. Yeah, I agree with you. Yes. Yay.
More inclusive of everything, but they do a 30-day start in the clinic.
Yeah.
They give them a medication, like pill and mouth, before you leave the door. And then what we've done at the city is, because we've heard from different clinics, like we're not always prepared when you get them to us to immediately continue, is we have a benefits navigation training, and so we have navigators in the clinic, and also in like the CBOs or in community-based health centers come in. And we go through, how do you get someone the assistance programs they need, or how do you evaluate some insurance programs to find a long-term sustainable coverage program? And also, so you're not starting someone on 30 days and then by the time they get to the clinic having a lapse in treatment because they're
right.
not coordinated. So
right.
we have that. It's a model. So it can actually, well, it's right now, some of it's New York City and New York specific, but they're developing a portion that's a model.
Yeah, great questions, great solutions. Yeah, New York's been really on the forefront of this, so it's been great. That's why they are close to reaching 90-90-90, right? You're getting there. Hey, Birmingham just became the 13th city to join the Fast Track City Initiative, I just want to point out. All right, what else can I tell you? I think it's 5:15, but you can go ahead, and then you can have the last word.
Okay, well, you can have the last word.
That's dangerous. Yeah, great question. I love this question. I just was reading about this. So the question is, if you're persistently exposed to HIV, does it leave immunologic footprints, is how I think about it. So can you detect mucosal antibodies to parts of the virus but remain uninfected? And if you're on PrEP, does that alter that response? When the PrEP studies were designed, there were a lot of immunologic sub-studies to go along with that. And I can't say that we know definitively, but I think that the early hope that PrEP might lower your set point if you are infected, I don't think it's totally clear because I think there have been so few real infections on PrEP that we haven't been able to really say that. There is evidence. You can find antibodies, mucosal antibodies to HIV in people who are persistently exposed but uninfected, particularly sex workers in Africa. There have been some really nice studies in those women. You know, why they remain uninfected and what the role of those antibodies at the mucosa is, we have no idea. So I think the question is, if you're on PrEP and you do get infected, can it help you? We don't know, because if you're really on PrEP, you're probably not going to get infected. If you're partially adherent and you're on PrEP, not so much, because, you know, it wasn't really sort of doing what it was supposed to in the first place.
Okay. The other thing is, we discussed, do you
point where we can discuss this with patients. Like, the longer it goes and non-transmission, does that make it less likely? Like, if there's a couple being scored on for 15 years, and we still discuss the score.
Ah.
Is this something you really want to discuss prayerfully?
So I let the patient, drive that conversation. So again, my patients who came in, my husbands, the two guys who came in who were married and said, you know, we've been together for 16 years, we're pretty monogamous, I want to try PrEP. I mean, that's a great example. They sort of said they use condoms, but So, I think the likelihood was that they were never going to transmit it, but did I let that go against giving them PrEP? No. Because, again, I think it's the patient who is driving it, and there are often reasons cogitating behind there that I can't even elicit from them, and I'm not even sure they can articulate sometimes. Not sure if that helps. All right, I should let you guys go to cocktail hour. Thank you very much. I really appreciate your participating.